Part 2, Chapter 4, in which Harvey attacks himself. Quote, Omnis mundi creatura, quasi liber et pictura, nobis est et speculum. From Vincent de Beauvais, Speculum Quadruplex. Every creature of this world is to us a book, a picture, and a mirror. After their drink on the terrace, Harvey and Roland walked down to the bay. The sun was still high in the sky, and its unimpeded rays reflected brightly on the rocks of the coast. As soon as they reached the shore, the captain tore off his clothes and leapt into the water. It was another world. The dry heat was gone, replaced by a turquoise cool, and a thousand types of fish and sea creatures rushed to meet him. Moving like a prehistoric eel, he coasted over an underwater cliff and watched as the ocean floor fell away beneath him. He felt as if he were flying, sailing upon the bosom of the waves, high above the white upturned eyes of the fishes that gazed in wonder. Halfway across the underwater canyon, a 20-foot white shark coasted into view. Overcome with the ferociousness of the beast, Harvey dove at him and bit his dorsal fin. The shark spun around and tore off the captain's right arm. "Arrgh!" cried the captain, bobbing to the surface. The fight that ensued might well have been the most ferocious in history. Even the tourists on the beach could tell there was something remarkable taking place beneath the thrashing white water. At one point, Harvey clamped his molars on the soft underbelly of the fish, and the shark leapt out of the water. "Jaws!" cried the bathers, rushing to safety. As the fight continued, the two moved closer and closer to the shore. A headstrong British child, in direct defiance of his mother, refused to leave the sea, and the shark headed straight for him. Harvey noticed the attack and swam to the rescue, grabbing the boy in his teeth and swimming to shallow water. As soon as he was out of danger, the child turned back and taunted the departing fish. "You think you're so mean," he said, "well, I showed you." Harvey, still sharing a touch of the shark's personality, leapt on the young braggart and tore a pound of flesh from his left gluteal. While the boy limped off crying to his mother, Roland helped Harvey to the shore. The captain was a mess. He had lost both of his arms and could see out of only one eye. Fortunately, the shark had not cared for the taste of his flesh and had spit out the limbs as soon as he took them. They were floating on top of the water until a young woman, wearing golden beach thongs, picked them up as they washed ashore. She brought them to Harvey. "Take these," she said, wrenching the salty arms into the bleeding stumps that hung from Harvey's shoulders, "and drink this tonic." The captain drank the liquid, vomited once, then stood and raised his now healthy arms to the heavens. "O enchanted elixir of Fierabras, cure to all wounds and wound to all cures, with you I am whole." Mahogany was still in the bedroom when Roland and Harvey returned to have another drink on the terrace. "Is gin and tonic okay?" asked R.T., standing at the bar. "Gin and tonic?" echoed Harvey. There was a chessboard on the coffee table, and they decided to play. But the contest was delayed by Harvey's inability to make the first move. The captain considered, as any existentialist might, that the first move would affect all others in the interplay of free will and determinism. As a result, he was unable to act. Instead, he played out the entire game in his head, tracing all the possibilities that might ensue from each possible opening. He saw, with impeccable acuity, that no matter what he did, his chances of winning or losing were the same. Of course, once he did begin to move, the odds changed, and certain moves became more important than others, yet their appearance in the game was still random and inevitable. Oftentimes, Harvey discovered, not moving a piece was more beneficial than moving it. He also saw how every move that was harmful to one player was proportionately beneficial to the other, and that each move carried with it the same allotment of good and evil. Therefore, no one move was better than any other. For Harvey did not want to beat R.T., whom he was imitating, and who was, subsequently, Harvey himself. The purpose of the game, then, was not to win or lose, but rather to prolong, in a sort of 1,001 nights, the sheer marvel and ecstasy of the struggle. Both men understood this, and consequently the match they played, though each moved constantly, was still to be decided after 14 hours. "This game," said R.T., manipulating a string of worry beads, "is equivalent to the writing of a novel. Just as the first brushstroke on the canvas limits the subsequent possibilities of the painting, and the first move on the chessboard determines the course of the game, in like fashion the author loses, with each word he pens, his creative liberty. He becomes alienated from himself by submitting to the theme he has chosen. Of course, it's worse for the critic. The writer loses his liberty in his own work, the critic in the work of another. And then there are the limits of one's skill, for I have ideas for whose realization I am incapable. I don't know how to write novels, but it pains me to stop writing them." "Was it hard to write my novel?" asked Harvey. "I wrote the first chapters of Part 1 in 1979, said R.T., "but didn't finish Chapter 16 until 2003. Now, in 2013, I am finishing the final draft of Part 2. So you see, it has not been easy, for what I have undertaken in the chess game of your novel is what Vincent de Beauvais essayed in his Speculum Quadriplex, that ambitious composition in which he wove together quotes from all the great authorities in the natural, moral, doctrinal, and historical sciences. You, my dear Harvey, are the result of my attempt to create a sort of human aleph, or point of existence at which all others unite, an XYZ axis, if you will. Following the lead of Alanus ab Insulus, one might say that Harvius et spherae intelligibilis cuius centrum ubique circumferentia nusquam. Translation: Harvey is an intelligible sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Of course, in expressing the universe, we are really only expressing ourselves. And every writer, said Harvey, continuing R.T.'s thought, though he be all men in one man, still has his own particular style, his own particular way of weaving, unweaving, and reweaving the visions of others. Clearly, said R.T., and what you choose to write about dictates how you live, because you focus on what you write about and tend to see only those things that are pertinent to your work. So you, Harvey, create my life as much as I create yours. And sometimes I use my work to embellish my life, for though I may never have these truths, at least I can have these dreams. I believe that every person aspires to the fullness of life, that is, to the sum of experiences which they are capable of enjoying. Nor is there a person unafraid of being cheated out of some part of their infinite patrimony. Lastly, said R.T., I might say that my chief purpose is to make people laugh, for I believe that the cultivation of laughter is the mission of all who love mankind. The two men became so involved in their game and their conversation that they lost track of the time, and R.T. was surprised when he glanced at the clock in the living room and saw it was 4:11 in the morning. "Time to get some sleep," he said, leaning back in his chair and dropping his feet on the chessboard. The wooden pieces made a clicking noise as they tumbled from the table and struck on the tile floor.